This is The Agenda. Local newsmakers, community leaders, and people in our valley making a difference. Here's your host, Dave Bernstein.
Hot enough for you? Oh, bad joke on a day like today. Yesterday we didn't actually hit our forecast high, and I hope that the weather service is wrong again today. And we'll get to our forecast again here in just a little bit, but we want to talk about some important topics, certainly some hot topics at that, with State Senator Brad Hawkins, who joins us on the agenda today. So, Senator Hawkins, thanks for coming in today. We appreciate it.
You are welcome, Dave. Thank you for having me, and good afternoon. Good to be with you, and good to be inside your cool KPQ studio. No pun intended.
I thought you brought literally in two water bottles there.
One water bottle and one Pepsi Zero. So,
all right,
we're going to stay hydrated here.
We wanted to talk about a number of items that we'll get to over the course of the hour. Want to talk about redistricting. Want to talk about firefighting funds from this past legislative session and how that may come into play for even this fire season. I wanted to ask as well about whether or not possible legislation could come forth in the next session about critical race theory. I'm hearing that maybe even the Department of Education may tie funding to that being incorporated into the lesson plan. And June 30th is looming here with a full reopening in our state. Governor Inslee is still hanging on to his executive powers authority, and I think we're going to be the 48th state to fully reopen as of June the 30th. So I know that's something that the legislature has tried to address, but we'll try to touch on all of that. Let's maybe dive in with redistricting, because I think there was just an event earlier this week and more to come. So let's talk about redistricting and the state legislature's role in this, and so let's dive in on that first.
Yeah, well, certainly a lot to talk about, so good to connect with you. Redistricting is a process that the legislature participates in every decade. So the state of Washington has state legislative district boundaries. There's 49 different legislative districts. I represent District 12. It's rather large, of Chelan County, Douglas County, part of Grant, and about half of Okanagan County, all the way up to the Canadian border. And each of the 49 different legislative districts are balanced every 10 years based on population. So when I cast a vote in Olympia and a senator from the Seattle area cast a vote, we're essentially representing the same number of people in theory. Now, geographically, it's different, because when you lay out that map of the state of Washington's legislative districts, it looks like a bunch of different size puzzle pieces, because some are larger geographically and some are smaller, more densely populated, but we each represent the same number. And every 10 years, based on the census data, so the 2020 census, then those districts get redrawn and rebalanced in a sense. And going forward, I think the ideal legislative district is approximately 156,000 people or registered voters. I don't know how they kind of determine that. So, and the 12th legislative district is a little bit shy of that, right now, according to the 2020 census. So the 12th legislative district is expected to grow in terms of geography. In fact, a lot of the central Washington and eastern Washington legislative districts are, in a sense, underreporting their population based on the 2020 census data. And the western Washington side of the state is overperforming with their population reports. So in a sense, what's going to happen is the central Washington and eastern Washington legislative districts are probably going to get bigger geographically, and the western Washington legislative districts are going to tighten up in terms of be more dense. And some people actually speculate and fear what that could do is essentially squeeze out one of the central Washington, eastern Washington legislative districts. Because if all the districts in central Washington and eastern Washington are getting a little bit bigger, then some of them are, in a sense, going to have to encroach over into western Washington to pick up population. And then statewide, it might be a little more difficult for Republicans to pick up some of the suburban districts that they used to be able to pick up in close elections. So there are some interesting dynamics, but in addition to the legislative districts, there are the federal congressional districts that are in play. We have 10 of those. That's not going to change. But the redistricting commission is comprised of 5 commissioners. There are 4 appointees, one by each caucus. So the Senate Republicans get one, the Senate Democrats get one appointment, the House Republicans and House Democrats, and then there's one more non-voting commissioner. And there is a 5-member bipartisan commission. This was established in 1983 based on a citizen vote to change our Constitution. And it's a wildly successful process, but takes about a year. And in November, we should have a good sense of what their proposal is. And then the legislature, in a sense, ratifies that next legislative session. And those districts, state and federal, will be in place for the next 10 years.
So it doesn't, in other words, if one party is in control right now, for instance, Olympia, we got the Democrats in control of both chambers of the legislature. This commission is totally bipartisan. Doesn't it sound like the party in control gets to draw the lines?
Right. It's bipartisan. I wouldn't say it's not political. I mean, it's definitely a political process, but in order for the final plan to be adopted and sent to the legislature for ratification, and the legislature doesn't really have that much of a say in it actually in the final approval, but, it has to have at least 3 of the commissioners' votes, and there's 3 of 4 commissioners. And so each of the caucuses gets to appoint someone. And some people wonder, it's like, that avoids a lot of the gerrymandering things, and it avoids a lot of the contention with court challenges. So Washington State really has an ideal process for how this is set up. But some people wonder, well, why is a city split? Why is a county split? Why is one side of the street one legislative district and the other side of the street is another legislative district? But it all has to do based on population, and they try really hard to make sure that those legislative districts are balanced. And so a community could get split or a county. Certainly I hope that our 12th district stays essentially the same, but it could pick up some population. At one time, when Clyde Ballard was serving, Cleellum, for example, was part of the 12th district. We could reach into Kittitas County. We could reach over a little bit into Whatcom County. If you think about it, the 12th district includes the western portion of Okanagan County all the way to the Canadian border. So if there's population to pick up, we're going to have to probably pick up some population one way or another, but I certainly hope that communities like Chelan and Douglas County, for example, can continue to remain in one legislative district.
Now, you say there's underreporting going on in the 12th district. Why would that be?
Well, I can't say it's necessarily underreporting. Maybe I used the wrong term, but, you know, the population projections, the Washington State was expected to grow in this 10-year period in terms of statewide population, and we just didn't see the reporting that we were hoping for in central Washington and eastern Washington. And some people speculate, well, could that ironically have to do with the former President Trump? And, you know, there are a lot of Latino members of the population that didn't want to report in central and eastern Washington. I mean, we really don't know. There were some contentions about citizenship status and the census and all that sort of thing. I'm not sure how that played out. I'm not sure if western Washington was just more on their game in terms of filling out their census information. There was obviously COVID and other things. But the reality is the western Washington portion of the state shows a higher population count, you know, per region or whatever than the central and eastern Washington. And what that's going to mean, since we still have the same number of legislative districts and congressional districts, is the central Washington and eastern Washington state legislative and federal congressional districts are going to get larger geographically to pick up population, and the western Washington districts are going to shrink a little bit and tighten up. And, you know, the political pendulum has already swung way over, and the Democratic members of the House and Senate have really gained majorities, wide majorities. And I think it'd be nice to bring some balance back into the legislature, but maybe over the next 10 years, some are speculating that it could actually be a little more difficult for the Republicans, like we did in the Senate. We once had majority in the Senate when I was elected to the Senate, but it might be even more difficult over this next 10-year period because of the way these population counts turned out.
Just real quick, I spotted this article in the Seattle Times over the weekend, and I think King County is considering going to a sort of, gosh, and I forget the term, but it is a preference choice type
ranked
of,
choice voting?
Yeah, yeah. And I don't know that every county can do this. I think Pierce County did it for a little while and went back, and any chance that that could catch on in other parts of the state? And if you could explain that, you basically, you sort of, they did this in New York, for instance, in their mayoral race, and it's why you talk about not knowing the election results right off the bat, but do you sort of, you kind of rank your choice.
Yeah. And
it takes a while to figure out who won.
Takes a while to count all those, because basically it's not just an all or nothing for one person. You actually can make a second choice and a third choice. I'm not sure how far they go down. But, you know, in Washington State, most people may not realize this, but we certainly had a lot of constituent communications after the last presidential election. But the election laws are designed in our state by state laws. And so we make that determination in our state. But of course, it has to get through the majorities in the legislature and be signed by our governor. So in any change would have to make its way through that process. And if certain counties or our state wanted to transition to ranked choice voting, that would be a long process that, you know, there have been some bills in the legislature to consider that. But I think if you remember, Dave, it wasn't really that long ago that our state transitioned to the top two system. It used to be, you know, you have to declare your party and one Republican would make it to the November election and one Democrat for every partisan position, county officials or whatnot. And we've changed that to be top two. So two Republicans could advance, two Democrats could advance, or however the voters decide. And that was a really long, hard-fought process. There were a lot of, I think, strong feelings on both sides with that top two system, but now I think is generally widely supported in our state. And I while I'm intrigued by the ranked choice voting, I have heard from constituents about it, and there have been some legislative proposals. I think when it comes to transitioning our voting system and structure, we have to be really thoughtful about how we do that and be very measured. And so that I'd want to sort of dip my toes into that water very delicately before we proceed with any changes.
Okay, I want to take a break here so we don't get too far behind on our commercial breaks here, and come back to talk about funding for firefighting. And we already saw more fires, I think, going into June statewide. And so let's find out what the legislature had already budgeted, and how quickly we're going to see that money pay off as we head into, my goodness, what you could argue is going to be the hottest month of, it's got to be the hottest month of June that we've seen because of these records that we're setting, and how we are poised to fight those fires going into this hot summer ahead. State Senator Brad Hawkins with us on the agenda today. That's next on KPQ.
Welcome back to The Agenda on News Radio 560 KPQ with Dave Bernstein.
We're talking with State Senator Brad Hawkins, and on the program today, got a lot of topics we want to cover, and certainly amongst them, firefighting funding. And I think I remember hearing that as we entered June, we had already seen more fires that the DNR had responded to by the time we got into June than at any previous season. Now, fortunately, they had not been large, but they were more frequent in number. And now we're seeing this record-setting heat. So let's talk about firefighting funding. The legislature really put a lot into funding for the future. So lay the groundwork for us, Senator Hawkins, and how we'll be poised for this particular fire season and then moving forward.
Yeah, it's going to be difficult. I mean, there's no way around it. We're definitely, things are getting warmer. Obviously, this week has been very concerning, and the 4th of July is coming up, and I certainly don't want to infringe on anybody's liberties around Independence Day, but I just want everybody to be very, very cautious and thoughtful about personal fireworks and some of these things. You know, if they get them at Indian reservations and things, just be very careful, because we have an unfortunate and devastating history of catastrophic wildfires here. The legislature has been stepping up much more significantly in recent years. I've sponsored some bills, as well as Representative Kretz and others. There was a major piece of legislation that passed this year related to new investments for forest health and firefighting investments. DNR Commissioner Hillary Franz is very pleased by that, and they've led the effort to secure some additional funding. It puts in place an over the next 4 and 6 years goals for how the legislature is going to put forward over $100 million per biennium extra towards a wildfire situation. But we have basically two issues when it comes to wildfire. We have the firefighting, which is the fire suppression activities, which we need to significantly scale up. We've expanded some air assets in the state of Washington to pre-position some equipment and empower some locals with some new equipment so that we can put out the fires, as you were mentioning, soon after they start, rather than just letting them burn and managing them once they get burning, right? And then the other issue is we need to be much more proactive and continue to be on the forest management activities. The strategic thinning of small diameter trees, the clearing of the underbrush, the more prescribed fire on a landscape that's responsible and healthy. All those things can really help over time, one, stimulate the economy, but two, reduce our risk of long-term catastrophic wildfire. So those two things together, I think, can be really important in it. So I want to emphasize it's not just the firefighting and the additional investments in air assets and human resources, but it's also the forest health long-term strategic effort. Both of those things, if we can continue to invest over the next several years, you know, it took us many years, unfortunately, to get in this situation with our landscape. We'll need several years, maybe a decade, to get out of this. So it's going to take continued investment, and I'm thankful that the state is just now beginning to place wildfire and forest health issues as much of a priority as mental health issues, education issues, and other important state policies. So we need to stay at it and really be cognizant as individuals about things we can do at the local level and being very responsible. It's not a wildfire season anymore. It's essentially a wildfire year. The wildfires are starting much earlier. They're going later until the snow falls. It's not just a central Washington and eastern Washington issue. It's we're starting to see more wildfires and wildland fires in western Washington as well. We had the Pearl Hill fires and those fires into September, and when we thought we were kind of out of the danger zone. So we just cannot rest at any point in the year, really.
Those were Labor Day weekend fires.
Yeah.
And what's different now, as I understand, we used to sort of rob Peter to pay Paul for fire suppression. Now we're front-loading that fire budget, fire suppression budget, to a much greater degree than we used to.
Yeah.
Is that true?
That's true. We're starting to front-load it much more aggressively. Basically, what the state did is we had this rainy day fund or budget stabilization account, and if the wildfire costs got to the point where they were so significant for, like, 2015 and 2016 during the Carlton Complex fire and the Okanagan Complex fire, I mean, we just pay for it all after the fact. But what we really need to do, what I think is a more prudent use of taxpayer dollars, and this is what the DNR has been saying as well, is to invest those dollars on the front end with more air assets, with more human resources, with empowering the local fire districts with some equipment so that we can start to put out those fires soon after they start rather than just get in a situation where we're managing them once they get started. And so if we can do that, then we can and invest in forest health, then we could put more money in the front end, which would actually have a return on the investment rather than just spending it all to reimburse the cost of fighting the wildfire the year before. And to me, that makes a much better sense from a taxpayer perspective and from a wildfire firefighting perspective as well.
Do we have enough money to get the job done this summer? I suppose that's a little bit of a pig and a poke question because, you know, you never know how bad it's going to get. But how are we poised to deal with let's say, the typical kinds of summers in wildfires, that summers that we've been having of late?
Well, it's a good question. So we did put more money up front, but also at the same time with this most recent state operating budget, which I voted against, the state is proposing over the next 2 and 4 years to essentially drain and fully exhaust and spend our rainy day fund. And that is the fund that we use to reimburse the firefighting costs if there are any cost overruns that we're not able to fund on the front end. So I am concerned with, on one hand, I'm excited that the state is investing more. On the other hand, I'm concerned with the reserve account that we have in the state and how much we're spending it down.
And last year, firefighting was, we were told, was going to be impacted by COVID. It was going to impact how you staged firefighters. Mm-hmm. That should be less of a degree, I would think, less of a concern this summer, I would think.
I think so, most definitely. But, you know, one of the big concerns with firefighting is how much wildfire is in the whole west, western region of the United States, even into British Columbia, you know, into Canada. Because we're all competing for those same assets. There's a lot of cooperation, and when we have a wildfire here, sometimes we're able to put out those wildfires soon if we can get that air resources from other states and other countries and things, we can all chip in. But when there are wildfires all across the western United States, into Colorado, into California, British Columbia, and we get those outbreaks here, we're not necessarily going to have those resources to draw from, which is the case Hillary France has been making at the DNR, and I wholeheartedly agree, which is why we need to invest in our own air assets in the state of Washington. And this is just the DNR lands. We have to be mindful that we have a major federal partner as well with the U.S. Forest Service, and they own a lot of federal lands, and wildfire knows no boundaries. And we need to make sure that the U.S. Forest Service, this is my ask of the feds, is being responsible, a responsible partner, and that they will also proactively thin their forests and clear the underbrush so that we have a healthy landscape across ownerships, state, local, and federal.
Speaking of assets, and we are talking with State Senator Brad Hawkins from the 12th District here. Were you familiar with an incredibly large aircraft that could drop just a huge amount of
weather? The Superliner.
Yeah, the Superliner. I think they did a little test run of it over in the Moses Lake area. It was forced to be grounded. The company that operates that privately just basically had to say, hey, cost so much money to operate this, and we couldn't get a contract. Do you know the story of why was Washington State not interested in that, or was there just not enough interest in paying for that service?
No, I do think Washington State is interested in it. In fact, Commissioner Franz was out at Moses Lake, I think, with our federal representatives, Congressman Newhouse, and potentially others, and kind of looking at that and seeing a demonstration for that reason. I think it could be a good asset to Washington State. Now, whether or not, an air asset like that over 2 or 3 helicopters that might be more nimble, you know, I don't know. I don't have that level of expertise as to what would be a better use of funds. Certainly a few helicopters in a certain area would be great. Also, one of my colleagues from Moses Lake in the 13th District, Representative Tom Dent, he's even suggested during the height of the wildfire season, even though I try not to call it a season anymore, but basically where we're at now, we could have some ongoing air patrols that are positioned with retardant to fly around and respond in air to any fires that are reported. So I think some opportunities like that, some continuous air patrols to be able, again, put out the fires soon after they start rather than trying to manage them once they get burning, and it wipes out a landscape. And that would be the last thing we want, too, after a year of being cooped up in COVID, to have smoke fill the air, to have to send away all our visitors. You know, it would be devastating to our economy. So we do not want that this summer and this fall. And I certainly hope that, you know, keep our fingers crossed that we can have a decent wildfire summer, you know, and fall this year.
Well, officially, as of today, the fire hazard raised to very high. That's third on the 4 tier scale of fire hazard in Chelan County that went into effect today. And the only level above that is considered extreme. And a reminder in Chelan County that fireworks are not permitted in Chelan County. Go to kpq.com and you can see all the rules and regs around Chelan and Douglas County. I think Grant County is listed on there as well here.
Let's enjoy the community fireworks celebration. I heard your report on that earlier, and I look forward to enjoying that celebration.
Yeah, it looks like that's going to be a go. 1:36 now. When we come back, we want to talk about some other matters with 12th District State Representative Brad Hawkins, and among them, tomorrow is June 30th. That's the day we're supposed to have our full reopening. Washington State will be the 48th in line to do that. And yet the governor is still hanging on to his executive emergency powers and authorities. We're one of, I guess we're the fourth worst state when it comes to that. And so we'll talk about that and how you could get a hold of your state senator, you could get a hold of your state representatives. You certainly couldn't get a response from the governor on that, although the legislature tried. So we'll talk about that. And also, I have a question about whether or not any critical race theory legislation could be proposed in this next legislative session. And we're hearing maybe the Department of Education may tie funding to that being included in the lesson plan. So we'll come back with that and more on the agenda with State Senator Brad Hawkins.
To reach the studios, call 663-5656 or send us your comments on the Plum Perfect text line, 663-5139.
All righty, we are back with State Senator Brad Hawkins, and we're going to, let's just touch on this just real quickly. We'll, I think, have you back maybe in about 2 weeks or so, and we can devote a lot more time to it because I've got several other things we want to get to. But I know you had put out some of your thoughts earlier when it was announced that we got for our Apple Capital Loop project, the largest infra grant funding amount in the cycle that was just announced. And I know there's a lot more to the pie that has to be obtained to complete the project, but this is a project that's going to get pieced together, and you got to start somewhere.
Yeah, so I was really thrilled. I've supported this Apple Capital Loop project, and kudos to Mayor Frank Kuntz and the city of Wenatchee. It's, I think, their third or maybe the fourth try at applying for this federal transportation grant. Putting in an application with the local partners for a $200 million collection of projects that they deemed to be this Apple Capital Loop. Not to be confused with our Loop Trail, but just a loop of projects, one of which most notably was the second bridge across the Wenatchee River, the Confluence Parkway. I think that's a $130 million component. That wasn't part of this recent federal grant, but how awesome. I mean, $92 million of federal funding for different projects. One, a connection of in the South Wenatchee community, a pedestrian overpass to our Loop Trail, but also the McKittrick Underpass and North Wenatchee Avenue improvements. I mean, we know North Wenatchee Avenue is kind of backing up. We're getting some federal dollars for those. There's still discussion about a statewide transportation investment package. You know, what projects are included in that and what the funding sources are as far as new gas tax or carbon tax or some combination of licensing fees and other things that a lot of people don't like, but they want their roads to be maintained and they want these new projects. So we still have some work to do as far as getting across the finish line for the Confluence Parkway Bridge and some other projects, but certainly this is great news and that'll help free up some capacity for us as legislators to focus on some other things if a new transportation package advances either this fall during a special session that Governor Inslee has alluded to, or next session or the following as far as a major multi-billion dollar new investment transportation package in the state.
Who would be in charge of, I guess, basically blessing, so to speak, building a new bridge? I mean, they don't really let you build new bridges. They might let you replace a bridge. Would that be a that would cross so many jurisdictions of agencies. Mm-hmm. Is that going to... Is that going to have to come with more of a federal agency, or is that going to be a stake? As you know, we're crossing a river there.
Yeah.
What's your best handicap?
Well, there is some, you know, federal agencies that are involved, especially when you talk about anadromous fish, you know, up the Wenatchee River and into the Columbia. But mostly it's Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, Department of Ecology. So a lot of the state level entities are North Central. DOT is already involved in that. In fact, we've already, you know, through the city of Wenatchee and some other funds that we've secured, been studying this and having this environmental impact statement process for the Confluence Parkway Bridge. So that is underway already, and usually that's the first step before we actually try to secure funding for something. We want to have done some of the preliminary environmental studies. I'm not sure if that is all completed at this point or not, but I think we're getting pretty close to be able to get the sign off to complete that bridge. And then once we get the funding for that, if we do in a statewide package, those are usually scheduled out over the next 10 to 12 years. And so it could be still a one or two decades before a bridge actually, you know, gets built. I mean, you've seen the West Kashmir Bridge, how long they've been planning that, but now thankfully that's under construction. But it takes a long time, even from the time that a package is approved to the time that the bridge actually starts construction. But hopefully we can get that going soon over the next decade or so, because we can't let too much time go by, because you can see how quickly our community is growing, and we're going to have some real traffic congestions and egress issues for emergencies if we don't get that second bridge across the Wenatchee River. So it's a project that I'm a big supporter of.
Well, Jason Mercier is a guest we have on here from time to time. He's with the Washington Policy Center, and he wrote, "Don't forget the emergency powers reform. As the state reopens, it may be sort of easy, I think, the point he's making, to go, okay, June 30th, that's tomorrow, we'll have most of the capacity issues on things addressed, although there'll still be certain aspects of pandemic requirements still in place. Masking requirements will still be in place in the workforce, you'll see. But as far as the legislature goes, you've tried to address that, the governor's emergency powers. He's still keeping that. He's still reserving that for himself. We will be the 48th state to fully reopen. You know, I guess you may not want to be the first to do anything. You certainly don't want to be the last to do something, and we literally are. And so somewhere in there is a happy, reasonable medium. And I don't think you could say that that's true here of Washington State. You tried to call a special session, and I think I mentioned earlier, I think that you would find that most people, if they complained to their senator or their representatives, they heard back from their representatives, not from their governor. So, and I'm sure you heard plenty from the 12th district.
Oh yeah, no doubt. And I think we've long passed that reasonable period. And the press has actually asked Governor Inslee, you know, is the emergency over? And he sort of, refuses to answer. But I think the reality is, you know, our state kind of needs to figure this out. And it's a state constitutional question, because we are only in legislative session for certain times of the year. For 105 days, 1 year when we do the budget, and 60 days the next year. So people with long pride are like, oh, we only had this part-time legislature. We're full-time legislators essentially, because we kind of work year-round regardless, but we're only in session part of the year. And it just coincidentally happened when this pandemic occurred, was right as we were leaving session, and the governor had all this time to sort of keep extending these orders. Then we tried to call back a special session. He wouldn't call us back, and basically he has to do that based on the state constitution. So there were a lot of issues. And then we proposed some legislation this year during the session to reform the Emergency Powers Act. The majority party didn't want to upstage the governor, even though I think a lot of them supported changes to emergency powers, didn't want to embarrass the governor. We weren't sure what the governor would even do if some of those bills successfully made their way through the legislature and landed on his desk. Would that be a potential embarrassment if he had to veto some of those? But to me, it's really not about Governor Inslee. It's about all his successors in that position. And it's about our state government. And that the bill that I co-sponsored for reforming the emergency powers would have allowed the governor to make either one or two proclamations. But after that, then if he would have wanted to extend, say, a second proclamation for another 30 days, he would have had to bring back the legislature, call a special session, bring everybody together to get the buy-in to do that. And I think, to me, that makes a lot of sense in terms of checks and balances in our state. So we're still pushing for it. I think a lot of people really want that. But I don't think this governor is very interested in doing it. And I don't believe the majorities that control the legislature want to upstage him in any way either. So it might just be an issue that we try to resolve when Governor Inslee has moved on to President Biden's cabinet or whatever he might do next. But it'll be interesting because I don't think the legislators or the members of the public have easily forgotten the need to make these emergency power reforms. Or, you know, there's always the option of a citizen initiative. They can bypass the whole legislature and make some reforms that way as well.
Well, there were some interesting points. Remember, we were the only state in the country to deem fishing unsafe during the early restrictions. Remember, you couldn't go fishing.
Or golfing.
Yeah, there were all kinds of things just very, very early on in this. Remember, the big box stores were essential businesses and remained open with the capacity limits, but remember the small businesses couldn't, even though they sold the same things. And then, of course, the list goes on and on. But we are the 48th state opening tomorrow, and you just kind of have to shake your head. I think Hawaii and is it Oregon? I think Oregon. Oregon and Hawaii are going to be behind us in line. Mm-hmm. So what are your thoughts on the lottery? Shot of a lifetime lottery of these incentive programs did not seem to work.
Yeah, you know, it's been really, I think, difficult. We had that initial wave of several weeks of people wanting to get vaccinated, and I got two of my vaccinations. My wife's been vaccinated. Our son, who's 13, has received both of his doses of his vaccine at this point. So I was eager to get vaccinated, and I think it opens up a lot of opportunities. But I certainly didn't want to force anybody to be vaccinated. The lotteries, that was kind of an interesting thing. I think partnering with some of the Washington private sector businesses like Microsoft who donated a bunch of Xboxes or whatever, you know. But it's going to be tough now. For a while there, it was really tough to get your appointment to get vaccinated. But once the sort of initial waves kind of died off, then basically they started, when they transitioned it to the health district, really limiting the number of days. It's like Monday through Thursday now. They're not doing it on Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And you drive by the town Toyota Center and there's hardly anybody in line now. So we have to, see what we can do as far as, you know, providing more information about people getting vaccinated. But honestly, some people just don't want to, and I think we have to respect that.
Yeah, they'd reached the capacity on demand, and you're not going to convince someone who doesn't want to get the shot to get the shot. Oh, well, now I can win some money. There's not a financial incentive for folks to get the shot that are dead set against it, and so.
And one thing I'd say too, Dave.
I was going to say the 30th was always looming. and it's tomorrow. So
it's finally here.
It's finally here. Exactly. All righty. Before we run out of time, just real quick, do you suspect that there might be anyone? I would suspect on the GOP side of the aisle in the House or the Senate that might bring forth some legislation that would oppose critical race theory instruction in Washington's public schools.
Well, I suppose there could be legislation introduced to, you know, prohibit critical race theory being forced on our public schools. I think that the bigger question, like the larger possibility, would be, you know, how much are some of the Seattle Democratic legislators and others going to continue to push some of these policies all throughout our state and our superintendent of public instruction, is a very smart person, but he is a former legislator from Olympia, which is one of the most progressive areas of the state. So what you're seeing either legislatively or from the agencies, the Office of Superintendent of Public Instruction, you're going to see probably more and more of some of those issues, more and more of some of the gender issues and other things. What I've noticed as a trend is there's not as much respect for local governments, you know, back to the governor's approach with sort of his top-down command and control set of directives with this COVID pandemic. Not a lot of local government flexibility. You're seeing the same sort of thing when it comes to schools, whether it's going to be this critical race theory or other things, is certain pockets of the legislature, mainly the Seattle progressives, want to dictate to all 295 school districts across the state what they should be doing, what they should be teaching, comprehensive sex health education and other things, making those decisions, essentially being the school board, not only the legislature, but the school board, and sort of eroding the local control of all these elected school boards all across the state. And I think that's the wrong move for just about any piece of policy, whether it's sex ed or critical race or gender issues or other things. Let's let these local school boards that are elected in their communities decide a lot of these important issues for their communities.
All right. Thanks for coming in today. We sure appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Dave.
All right. Stay cool. Happy 4th of July.
Absolutely. And be safe, everybody.